You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Georgia O'Keeffe is probably best known for her larger-than-life paintings of flowers, soaring Manhattan skyscrapers, and barren New Mexican landscapes. But a new exhibit at the Whitney Museum, Georgia O'Keeffe Abstraction, reveals an entirely different side of her work. The show includes over 125 paintings, drawings, and sculptures that she made throughout her life. And in his review of the exhibit, New York Magazine's Jerry Saltz called O'Keeffe a powerhouse who makes the non-objective feel mystical, familiar, objective, and subjective all at once. The show, which is on view through January 17th, was organized by Whitney curator Barbara Haskell and curators from the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum and the Phillips Collection. I'm very pleased that it brings Ms. Haskell back to our show today. It's always
a pleasure
to see you. What did the word abstraction mean to O'Keeffe? And I want to expand on that a bit, because when I did a show recently on the Kandinsky exhibit at the Guggenheim, listeners wrote in to complain that we were using the words abstract and non-objective interchangeably.
Well, for O'Keeffe, it actually changed over the course of her career. When she first started out in 1915, which was amazingly early, she really used abstraction to say things. And in her letters, again and again, you have her speaking about her urge to actually speak. Did you understand what I was trying to say? I made it to tell him something. And it was a way for her to express these ineffable, intense feelings that she could not put into words.
Well, it was an early time in abstraction. There were some other American artists working in that way, all coming out of nature, like Arthur Dove.
Yes, absolutely. I think the only difference with O'Keeffe in this early period is that she actually, this sense that she was trying to express very intense personal emotions, not so much to extract the essentials from a subject, but to express something very personal. As you say, that was a common thread among a number of artists. But O'Keeffe's early instinct that it was a language of actually communication, that through form and color she could say things that couldn't be expressed, were too ineffable for words.
It's the sort of thing that Kandinsky was saying when he said that abstract art and music were similar, that you could say things abstractly that you couldn't say through representational painting.
Absolutely. And the whole music is a paradigm for an abstract language that could express emotions was something that O'Keeffe held dear, as well as a number of her colleagues.
Well, I think these paintings have always been around, but why have they not been given the same kind of attention the other work has received?
Well, it's interesting. For one thing, in the whole body of her work, she lived such a long time that the percentage of them was less than her other work, than the bones and the flowers, and then that work was more accessible. It's easy to recognize a bone in the desert and to sort of feel the subject matter, and to deal with an abstraction, one has to communicate with it. I think that they speak to viewers. It's clear watching people go through the Whitney exhibition that she does tap into something that resonates with people, that experience of the sublime, the sort of joy and exaltation that we have at moments of being in nature or being an experience that's totally overwhelming.
Didn't she actually begin her career as an art teacher with little intention of becoming an artist?
Well, that's what's so fascinating. She did. She came out of an art education tradition. She studied with a man named Arthur Wesley Dow, who really believed that art was something that applied to everyday life, and that if you taught young children harmony and principles, that they could apply that harmonious sense of a piece of paper and apply that to their everyday life.
So he was saying that art had a social function.
Absolutely.
And did she apply that the rest of her life?
No, she didn't. She was she belonged to, you know, the women's movement in the early days, but she was not a political person.
Did things change when she met Alfred Stieglitz?
It changed in the sense that when he brought Stieglitz encouraged her to come to New York in 1918, and it was probably Stieglitz that encouraged her to turn to oil painting, which she did in 1918. And then, of course, because he was her dealer, he promoted the work and was very instrumental in how it was appreciated by the critics.
Well, he was a key figure in introducing Americans to the avant-garde art of Europe, as well as our own early abstract painters.
Yes. I mean, he taught America how to see abstraction and how to see modern art.
And she was a student at Teachers College when they first met.
That's right.
He was a lot older than
she. He was 24 years her senior.
She would soon say that she'd rather have Stieglitz like her art than anyone else. Where did this immediate sense of respect and admiration come from?
Well, when she was a student at Teachers College, she went into Stieglitz's gallery, 291, and looked at the Picasso that he was showing and the John Marin watercolors, and she listened to him talk. He was a charismatic individual and mesmerizing, and like many others, she was mesmerized by him.
But she ended up taking a job at a women's college in South Carolina right after she met Stieglitz, and she said that period was one of the best times in her life.
Yes. Well, she enjoyed being alone, as is clear, after Stieglitz died and she moved out to New Mexico. And I think the thing about that South Carolina period when she was teaching and all by herself is it gave her tremendous liberation. It gave her the freedom to do what she wanted to do.
And she worked mostly in charcoal, which is hard to imagine. O'Keeffe not using color in
her work. Right. She's a great colorist.
And then she decided to expand by using blue?
Yes, that's right. We found a book at her library that advised artists to first use charcoal, work in black and white, and then when they turned to color, to begin to use one color at a time. And yes, blue was the color that she adopted first.
And when did she show all of this work to Stieglitz?
Well, it's interesting. The sort of mythical story is that she had been sending charcoals to a friend of hers, Anita Politzer, who was a classmate at Teachers College. And Politzer took the charcoals into Stieglitz's gallery on New Year's Day, 1916. And he clearly liked them. The sort of mythical recounting is that he said, "At last, a woman on paper." And that may or may not be true. As it turns out, that was written in the margin of a letter rather than in the body of the letter. But he did respond to them, and they started corresponding at that point.
And then while she was still teaching, she got her first show in 1917.
That's
right.
She had come back to New York to finish her degree at Teachers College. And then that spring, he included her in a three-person show at the gallery.
It must have been an exciting time because there were a number of artists who were doing exciting work. She met Paul Strand, has to be one of the greatest photographers that ever lived, and also showed at the gallery.
Absolutely. In 1917, when Stieglitz gave her her first one-person show, she came to New York for a kind of whirlwind 10-day crash course in modern art. She met Paul Strand, and she wrote to her friend Politzer that she fell head over heels for Strand and for his photographs. And they did, in fact, have an impact on her work, the sense of close cropping and the abstraction that comes from cropping out the backgrounds and focusing in tightly on a subject.
He had a way of taking something real and making it into something almost emblematic.
That's right. And she learned from that. She also learned from being the subject of Stieglitz's photographs of her. Stieglitz began taking her photograph in 1917 and created this portrait series that lasted throughout the time he photographed over 300 images.
And you've included some of those pictures in the exhibit. These are rather frank nudes.
Yes, exactly. And when he exhibited them in 1921, they confirmed the idea that O'Keeffe's work was essentially sexual. These images of this, nude, semi-clothed, free spirit that he presented to the world. She became, as one of the critics at the time said, an overnight celebrity. Everyone knew her name. He was 24 years older, still married, and it, as McBride said, it put her on the map.
So he was still married to his previous wife.
Yes, and it was a double-edged sword for her when she had her first-person painting show 2 years later. The critics were confirming what the portraits had suggested, interpreted her work as orgiastic, as sort of, portraits of the female sexual experience.
They saw her in a feminist context.
Absolutely.
But George O'Keeffe has often been seen in a feminist context. There have been any number of articles that I've read over the years that have suggested that she would not be as respected if she wasn't such an important figure for many women as an artist, in the same way that Frida Kahlo has become important.
Well, I think clearly the fact that she was a success as an artist in the teens and the 20s, when very few other artists, female artists, were able to achieve that level of recognition, she has become a role model for women.
My guest is Barbara Haskell, who is the chief curator of a show at the Whitney Museum of Art called Georgia O'Keeffe Abstraction. There's also a book from Yale University Press. And by the way, we also have a slideshow from the exhibit on our show page at WNYC.org. Quite wonderful images, in fact. But she had this big show at the Anderson Gallery that you mentioned, where the critics kind of made her into a feminist. And then she kind of abandoned abstraction for a while.
Well, she didn't really. She wrote to the critic, Sherwood Anderson, or the writer, that she was going to introduce objective pieces in her next show because she didn't like what the critics had said about her 1923 show. But in fact, she continued to make abstractions throughout the 20s into the early 30s, and they remained in some ways the largest body of work that she did. She introduced flowers and she began to introduce the New York cityscapes, but abstraction formed a large part of her output.
Well, there seems to be a dialogue between the flowers and the abstract paintings.
Absolutely, and that we've included some in the show that, in a sense, oscillate between abstraction and realism.
And then she left Manhattan pretty much for New Mexico in 1929. Was she still married to Stieglitz?
She was, and they remained partners throughout the rest of his life. She would set him up at the Stieglitz estate in Lake George in the summer. She'd go to New Mexico, and then she'd return to New York, and they lived together.
Well,
you know, as husband and wife,
somebody,
even though he was having an affair with someone else. And it wasn't until after he died in 1946 that she moved permanently to New Mexico.
Did the stock market crash have an effect on her situation?
You know, in a sense, it didn't. She was one of the people in the gallery that sold very well. And although, you know, there was a sort of a depression in the sales during the 1930s, in a sense, she was immune from it. People love the work from the very beginning.
In a lot of her work, the Jack and the Pulpit series, many of the paintings of animal bones, there's repetition. Why did she paint the same motif, shape, subject over and over and over again?
Well, I think what's interesting about the abstractions is that although she draws from a similar vocabulary and works in series. Sometimes she literally works in a series where she'll explore a single motif over three or four different pictures. That in the abstraction, she varied it enormously. And walking through the gallery, you don't find a repetition of motifs. It isn't until she moves out to New Mexico that you begin to find this kind of recycling of forms that you've spoken about.
In fact, she tries to capture some of her experiences, as you said earlier, in the abstractions. One of them involved going under anesthesia.
Yes. It was an amazing picture that is relatively, you know, blacks and grays, and it captures that feeling of the, you know, as the anesthesia begins to take hold and the room begins to circle, and the last thing she sees is this light that at the ceiling.
Wasn't she commissioned to paint a mural at Radio City Music Hall, $1,500? Whatever happened to
that? That was turned out to be a sort of a watershed for her. She had Alfred Stieglitz, as you mentioned, had started an affair with a much younger woman, and she took the commission.
A younger woman. She wasn't young enough for him.
That's right. And she took the commission at Radio City Music Hall against Stieglitz's wishes. It was the first time she'd really gone against what he, as her agent, had wanted. He thought it was she had accepted a commission for too little money and it was too commercial. And she did it anyhow. And she worked all summer working on the canvas. And when she went down in the fall to put it into the powder room to actually install it, the plaster was too wet and the canvas came off the wall. And it because of the situation of Stieglitz having been against the project, she needed it to be a success. And when it wasn't, it was devastating. And she did go through a period of withdrawal. She had a nervous breakdown and didn't paint for a year and a half.
In 1946, she had a retrospective exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art, which was one of the first given to a woman. Clement Greenberg gave her a scathing review. Why?
Scathing. Well, he was he was arguing for abstraction, and her work was clearly representational. At least in that show, she was, you know, included images that were recognizable, and that was one of the main things. He hated everything about it.
Well, she was going back and forth, and still painting some abstract paintings.
That's right. She did throughout her life, even into the 50s. She painted a number of abstractions that at the end of her life that she returned to.
And near the end of her life, the Whitney gave her a major retrospective.
Yes, in 1970, that was also a turning point for her reputation. She hadn't been shown in decades. After Stieglitz died, she was with the Downtown Gallery for a moment, but then she left and didn't have any public exhibitions of her work. So she sort of vanished from people's minds. And the 1970 show, in a sense, reintroduced her to America. And people lauded her work. She became, in a way, an overnight celebrity.
Do you see her influence on other artists?
It's interesting. I don't.
The color field artists, for example?
Well, I think that she's in step with a number of color field artists. And those late works from the 50s are exactly what a new generation of artists are doing, large planes of flat color. But I think it wasn't so much that she influenced them as it was that she was in step with what they were doing or preceded them. Had an intuition of what was coming next. But her work is so singular. The color is so specific, and the sense of space that she creates, of space not flat, not shallow, but space moving in and out, is something so particular to her. It's very hard for people to imitate it without looking like imitators.
Although her work is always recognizable. For much of it has diagonals in it, has a lot of curvy stuff. And then when she's in New Mexico, we have this series of paintings that are almost, I don't know what words to use, almost minimal paintings, geometric.
Yes.
The exact opposite. And yet somehow they all look like O'Keeffe's.
That's right. It's amazing. Those late patio door pictures are absolutely geometric. She uses these flat geometric planes of color. And yet there is something about her color, the palette, which is recognizable.
Barbara Haskell is the Whitney curator responsible for this new show called Georgia O'Keeffe Abstraction, which will be running through January 17th, also contributed to by curators from the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum and the Phillips Collection. There is a book, also called Georgia O'Keeffe Abstraction, published by Yale University Press. And we have a little exhibit of it on our show page as well. Just one more thing. Were all of these paintings available, or did you have to go hunt some of them down?
Well, we knew what they were. There was a catalog resume of her work that's come out. The sort of challenge was to encourage people to lend them to the show, and we were able to get a grouping of it's the largest O'Keeffe show ever. And I think people responded to the notion that she was ready for a reappraisal.
Are they in good shape?
They're in very good shape.
Including the pastels?
Very good shape. She has the surfaces of the work are impeccable.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.